Welcome back to part three, Barbara Streisand, the good, the bad, and the crazy. I'm Brian.
I'm Sean.
Sean, the road gets rougher, it's lonely and tougher. With hope you burn up, tomorrow he may turn up.
And all because of that man that got away.
Yeah, and in this instance, this was the Hollywood classic that got away. Ladies and gentlemen, it's perhaps sacrilegious that we're invoking the immortal words of Judy Garland in what is probably the best musical performance, frankly, one of the best performances ever committed to film, in the 1954 A Star Is Born. But if we are being sacrilegious, then Barbara Streisand was equally sacrilegious.
She's defecating on a relic.
Yeah, because frankly, A Star Is Born is more than just a movie. It is Hollywood's founding gospel, right? From the earliest versions in the early studio days when it was called What Price Hollywood, and then in the kind of big, glossy 50s musical with Judy Garland and James Mason, A Star Is Born is the movie that Hollywood loves to tell over and over again, and will soon be telling yet again, and I'm sure we'll get to that. Sean, I mean, you and I are both Catholic boys. It's a bit like watching, you know, the Stations of the Cross, but just with, like, different actors put in as, like, Jesus and Saint Veronica and whoever, you know, and with different hairdos, 50s, 30s, 70s, you know?
I agree, although I do think that you are worshipping false idols here, so I would back down from that sin you're about to commit.
Judy Garland is not a false idol, darling. Give me Judy Garland over Pope Benedict any day.
All right.
Okay, so we did have some debate whether we knew we were going to do The Way We Were, Nuts, and A Star Is Born. And the question was, is Nuts bad or crazy? Because Nuts is obviously nuts, but it's just plain bad. A Star Is Born is bad on a whole other level. I have to admit, I felt a kind of euphoria watching this movie.
Did you feel a kind of relief knowing that it was bad as well?
The movie is bad, but it's also insanely engaging, just in the way that watching a narcissistic woman exhibit every single trait amplified to the nth degree is just fascinating. Do you know what I mean? Like, okay, Nuts gives you such a flimsy set and a cheap, shoddy production and just no tension. And A Star Is Born throws at you musical numbers, hairdos,
whiskey bottles,
songs,
helicopters,
outfits, Ferraris, drug use, just like
mansions,
just like
bullets, everything,
like all of it. And, you know, the spectacle of Kris Kristofferson, which is something we need to talk about. I think you and Barbara have the same taste in men, Sean.
Yeah, Kris Kristofferson and James Brolin.
And not to mention Mandy.
Oh, Mandy.
So I guess what I'm saying is, while A Star Is Born is, I mean, it is an ant compared to the amazing, towering achievement of the George Cukor, Judy Garland version, the 1976 Barbara Streisand, John Peters version, I would say is well worth people seeking out, especially if you're a Barbara fan. Like, I will say, I don't think you can understand Barbara until you've seen A Star Is Born.
I think I've spent a little bit too much time with Miss Streisand in the last few episodes, Brian. I think I'm ready to go out into the real world to show everyone that I'm not nuts. Sorry, hangover. We were very lucky to see this on the big screen, weren't we?
It just so happened that we had planned these episodes at the same time that the British Film Institute was screening A Star Is Born. And that's what I'm saying. I am so glad that we saw this movie with stereophonic sound, bigger than life, because that is how this movie should be seen. And it's worth saying that even though this was a famously troubled production, which curious listeners should go and listen to Karina Longworth's episode in the early days of You Must Remember This, which I think intrigued both of us about A Star Is Born, because she goes into all the behind the scenes, you know, squabbles and issues. They were much covered in the press at the time. But the movie was also a massive hit. It was the second most financially successful film of 1976.
Doesn't it make you sad that, you know, long gone are the days where the second most successful film in America can star Barbara Streisand?
Well, if you really want to know, Sean, I want to go back to 1965 to 1967, where the top grossing films of the year starred Julie Andrews from, like, her run from The Sound of Music to Thoroughly Modern Millie. But that's a whole other story. Julie Andrews was the Arnold Schwarzenegger of her day, it has to be said.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, but we're not doing dueling divas here. Okay, so, like, why was this movie a hit in 76? Is it just because of the music? Like, this movie is strung together from the plot of the original Star Is Born and then just these big set piece concert numbers one after another.
Well, you know, it is an event picture. I mean, like you said, it comes with the baggage or with the weight, you could say, either one, of it being a remake of a classic Judy Garland film. You have very, very sexy Kris Kristofferson. You have Barbara, who, you know, is a star, even if she's not always the most contemporary of stars. It taps into that kind of huge, spectacular concert, you know, zeitgeist.
I mean, vocally, Barbara is delivering a powerhouse performance just on a technical level of her voice. Like, wouldn't you agree?
I agree, yeah.
Like, every single number, she is just insane with her ability to belt it out. You know, the new belter, as Ethel Merman said when she appeared on the Judy Garland show. And, I mean, that's the other amazing thing, is, like, Barbara stepping into the shoes of Judy. They knew each other. They'd worked together.
Yeah, happy days get happy.
Yeah, in some ways, Streisand was, you know, thought of and groomed as the successor to Judy. But when it came time to make this project in 76, it's clear that what Streisand and her team, most notably boyfriend slash producer John Peters, wanted to do with this movie was to make Barbara hip, right?
Yeah, because didn't he say that she was always doing period pieces? And I was like, what? And you were like, well, The Way We Were was a period piece. Funny Girl is a period piece.
I mean, even What's Up, Doc, which is very 70s, is, like, basically a remake of Bringing Up Baby.
Yeah, and so John Peters wanted Barbara to have a leading role in something that was really going to connect her with a young audience.
Do you want to just give our unaware listeners a bit of a briefing on who John Peters was?
So John Peters, I mean, where's... I was going to say, where's the John Peters movie? But there already is one. So John Peters was a very well-connected hairdresser in 1970s, 60s and 70s Hollywood. And he knew everybody, and he was handsome, and he was straight, and he bedded all these women. And for some reason or another, he managed to become a producer, and for an even stranger reason, he became head of, I believe, Paramount Studios.
Well, this was the first movie that he produced. Like, he and Barbara produced this together.
And he was illiterate.
Yeah. So, basically, he was this Svengali of Barbara's for a few years, and then he... I mean, let's give the man credit. Like, he and Barbara produced what was the second most successful film of 1976, so he was doing something right. But clearly, from all the things I've read and heard, like, he was obsessed with the fact that this was his girlfriend.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he wanted to show off how sexy she was. He wanted to emphasize her ass, her tits. He told her not to wear a bra. Like, and it's so clear when you watch the movie that, like, the intent is to objectify Barbara. We didn't actually mention that in Nuts, there were those softcore that Richard Dreyfuss finds from her prostitute character in her bedroom. I wondered if those were taken, like, you know, by John Peters, because, like, he seems to be the person who thinks Barbara Streisand is just, like, the hottest number ever.
Well, I don't know what he was doing with that hairstyle, okay?
Do you think he did that hairstyle?
I don't know. I mean, like, you know, I have a mustache, Brian.
Okay? I know, so do I.
You know, there was a time where I would look at pictures of my father with a mustache in the early 90s and think, oh God, what a terrible look the mustache was, you know? And now I look back at it and think, wow, my dad had a really great mustache. But I'm never going to look back at Barbara Streisand with that really tight, curly, kinky hair and ever think it was good or flattering or hip. It is embarrassing.
Well, but, okay, I know what you're saying, right? It's that kind of, like, I mean, I hesitate to call it an afro, but it's this, like, giant ball on top of her head of, like, really tight Semitic curls. I mean, how would you describe it?
I mean, we can use your word, it's always.
At one point, there's a hilarious moment where she's singing with two black backup singers, and the radio producer is like, "You there on the right, you're a bit too loud, quiet down." And like, "Which one are you talking to?" He's like, "The kinky-headed one," by which he means Barbara.
Yeah.
Yeah. But here's the thing, she has curly hair in The Way We Were as well.
I know, but it's... I'm not against curls. It's just, obviously, you know that's a permanent. The fact that you would do that to your hair, to treat it, to make it look like that, I don't get it.
It's also, it's completely emphasized throughout the... So her ass is emphasized in ways that we can enumerate, I'm sure. But the hair is, like, you just can't escape it because of how the lighting works.
I remember one time hearing, I think it was Michael Kors, don't quote me, but he said, only one person looks good backlit, and that's the Virgin Mary.
But see, this is back to my, like, Stations of the Cross thing. Like, it's trying to give Barbara a halo.
It looks like she's wearing a helmet, okay? It does nothing for her.
But it's like, it sometimes glows in all these different ways. Like there's a few musical numbers, including the very first one. Like, it's her first appearance when she's performing in the Oreos, which is the name of her group.
Her problematic.
Yeah, so do you want to
just... have that word then, did we?
Do you want to just describe why they're called the Oreos?
Okay, so an Oreo biscuit is two...
Cookie.
Excuse me. keep that in. An Oreo cookie is two black pieces of biscuit and a white creamy center. Okay? And so, basically, this problematic band starring Barbara and her two backup girls.
She's, like, in between these two girls who are nameless and have no character, but she's, like, lit with this glowing red kind of light.
Yeah, as if the devil's eyes were lighting her.
And, of course, this is where Kris Kristofferson first encounters her and both falls in love with her as a talent, as a woman, as a sexual object. So, I mean, I think in a lot of ways, the plot line of A Star is Born is well known to cinephiles, but can we just describe the basic trajectory of the plot of all the versions of A Star is Born, and then maybe talk about how this version screws around with that?
Okay, so basically, the plot of A Star is Born is that there's a famous older... successful man who's on the way down slightly, and he's on the way down partly because of the times are changing, but also because he usually is an alcoholic or has a drug problem or a variety of things.
Okay? He's sort of self-pitying and self-destructive.
Yeah, stumbles upon a talent that he believes is raw and brilliant and stunning, and not only does he feel that he can nurture this talent, but he believes that this woman is going to give him a love that will turn him around.
And he then proceeds to not only begin a relationship with her, but also to kind of groom her into being a star in her own right. And as her career ascends, his plummets even further, and their romance is the ironic thing that gets destroyed, so that, you know, for our leading lady, she becomes a major success in star Hollywood terms while losing, you know, everything that she cares about emotionally.
Yeah, and it's kind of like you can have one or the other, but you can't have both.
Right. And it works beautifully when it's Judy and James Mason giving, you know, really intense, rich, psychologically complex, full-bodied form to these... what they're really archetypal characters, you know? And also Judy delivering some incredible musical numbers, most notably The Man That Got Away, the whole Born in a Trunk sequence, you know? Mm. And just, like, scene after scene that is both emotionally vulnerable, technically incredible, and just sometimes psychologically painful to watch.
Yeah, now this is where I would interject and say that although A Star is Born 1976 has a lot of problems, I think one of the hardest things it has to grapple with is the fact that it's set in the music industry. Because, you know, the original A Star is Born, or the, we call it original, the Judy Star is Born, is about stage and screen. And it's kind of easier to note someone's downfall if they're acting on stage or in your cinema and seeing someone else kind of go up. Because musicians are either cutting an album or touring an album or making an album or on hiatus. It's just that little bit harder to note that he's actually on the way down. Do you know what I mean?
Well, it's kind of because he's incredibly self-destructive from the very first scenes of the movie, right? Like, and rock stars are kind of known for being outrageous and self-destructive. We are supposed to get the point that the Kris Kristofferson rock star, whose name, what, John Norman?
Yeah, John Norman Howard.
Yeah.
The Norman is a reference to, in the 1954 version, it's Norman Maine, and we should say that Barbara is called Esther Hoffman, and Judy is called Esther Blotchett. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right, Blotchett. Yeah. So they've clearly identified that she is indeed a Jew, Esther Hoffman.
Well, do you notice that she wears a very small Star of David around her neck?
I watched the movie intently, and I did not notice
that.
Oh,
yeah, so she does very small around
very
her neck.
Good. There's a funny line where she says, "My name is Esther Hoffman," and then Kris Kristofferson says, "Wow, Esther Hoffman. In the past year, you're probably the first girl I've got with who has a last name."
Yeah.
That was a good line.
That was a good line.
We should say, who wrote this screenplay?
Joan Didion, who I know is supposed to be really important, but for what, though? I can't remember.
Joan Didion is probably the most highly respected living nonfiction writer in American letters. Mm. So, slouching toward Bethlehem, she is basically the premier essayist of the 70s, the 80s, Year of Magical Thinking. It was written by...
Oh, what about the great Camille Paglia, please?
I am the Sontag of the 90s, there is no doubt. But no, like, Joan Didion is up there with Sontag and all the others, and kind of, I think, particularly known for writing about California and the 70s and the kind of Manson era, Haight-Ashbury, all that whole scene was where her teeth.
Yeah.
And so she wrote this film with her husband, John Gregory Dunn. So this script was floating around, and John Peters, who, I mean, this is the irony of it. Like, he wants to bring Barbara up to date, so he's like, let's make a remake of this movie from 54 that had Judy Garland in it, but we'll just throw in lots of tits and sex and drugs. I mean, to the extent that it works, it is a very visceral kind of 70s type concert film. Like, right from the beginning, you're thrown into a concert where Kris Kristofferson is performing, and it has this, like, intense, rowdy energy that you feel like a Grateful Dead concert might have.
I think actually that's one of the film's strongest points. There's kind of an energy to what you expect 60s and 70s big concerts to be. They just feel so much less like, you know, privatized security at the door, you know, with the bleeper things checking the barcode of your tickets, and, you know, it just feels a little bit looser.
Well, yeah, because there's like a sign at one point in one of the concerts that says no drugs, and then it's like cutting to everybody like shooting up, well, not shooting up, but like toking and like, you know, snorting cocaine, Kris Kristofferson is right before he goes on. There's no health and safety checks. At one point he rides a motorcycle around the stage and everybody's excited, and then he, like, flies off the stage and, like, you know, injures several people by smashing the speakers in front of him.
You're gonna kill yourself!
Just giving them what they want!
But also, don't you think there seems to be a diversity in the audience, especially in that very first scene? It seems to be, like, a real motley crew of people who are there to see him. I mean, now it's all girls at Coachella with flowers in their hair, you know? And people in Native American headdresses, you know, offending everybody.
There were a few Native American appropriations in this movie, which we'll get to. Can we just dwell briefly on Kris Kristofferson? It's his musical performance that the movie begins with before Esther gets introduced. Like, do you know anything about Kris Kristofferson? Do you care about him?
I know he's a Rhodes Scholar.
Yes.
He's more known as a singer, and I believe of, like, kind of country stuff, because Kris Kristofferson used to be in Ireland a lot.
Yeah?
Yeah. Because, you know, we have a very, very big country and western music scene in my country.
Yeah.
And I believe Kris Kristofferson, you know, would have been there with Willie Nelson and the rest. I don't know why I had that in my head. I hope he's not some, like, rock star that I'm mixing up.
But, I mean, they're definitely painting him as a rock and roll star here. Like, it feels like it's maybe modeled after the Grateful Dead or something like that. Like, his his songs are these kind of gravelly voiced yelling type things. One of them is literally called Go to Hell.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so he sings the song Go to Hell, and they all wear these like crazy rubber masks of like monsters and Donald Ducks, and people in the crowd know this is a gimmick, and they're, you know, wearing them and also like ripping them off in unison with him. But you get the sense that he used to, like, you know, really own this scene, and now he's forgotten all his lyrics and he's late and there's been like court orders to get him to perform, and he's just completely wants nothing to do with it.
That's always the worst reason to perform, isn't it?
A court order. Court order, it's the worst.
Ask Whoopi Goldberg, she knows all about it.
Okay, so obviously he escapes from this initial first concert. He sees Barbara performing with the Oreos. Yet another fight breaks out, and this time the fight is incited. Sean, you had an amazing ability throughout this movie to identify character actors appearing in cameo roles who would go on or had previously been in other memorable things. And the first one you spotted was, you whispered to me...
Well, the thing is, I knew who the actor was, but if I told you the name of the actor, it would mean nothing to you.
So the actor's actual name is...
Robert Englund.
Actually, that would have meant something to me.
But would it have meant something to you immediately?
Not immediately, but for those who don't know his most iconic role.
Yeah, so I turned to Brian and said, that's Freddy Krueger!
So basically, Kris Kristofferson gets into a fight with Freddy Krueger while Barbara is trying to sing. And I have to say, like, in the early bits of the movie... Barbara, because she's meant to like be an undiscovered talent, right? So she is playing that role with the most faux naivete that anyone has ever done. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like, oh my god, like these guys are really making a lot of noise while I'm trying to sing. And she's like, she's got these like doe-eyed expressions, like, I can, you know, oh, you're interrupting my act, like, my god, you know. But she has none of the force that we know 1976 Barbara clearly has.
I thought that the part where she kind of shows him up for blowing her act was really good. So Kris Kristofferson is in this club and he's wrestling with the waitress first, because he has a bottle of like absinthe or something, or he wants a bottle of that. Basically, he has a bottle.
I think it's vodka.
And she's like, you can't drink this here, you have to buy a drink. It goes back and forth, and Barbara comes down at the end of one of her songs, and she just kind of sticks the microphone under his mouth, so his conversation becomes amplified. And then he realizes what's happening, and she just says, you're blowing my act. I like that. I thought it was authentic.
When the whole scene erupts into a melee, he drags her out into a limo and they drive around. And again, this is like, you know, straight from the 54 version. He's clearly infatuated both with her talent and with her. She goes back to her house. She will not take him in. He clearly wants to bed her. And she's like, come back in the morning for breakfast. I'll make you some beaten biscuits.
Do you know what I was thinking watching that?
What?
His mouth must be so dry.
Why?
Because he just drinks alcohol all the time. Like, genuinely, do you never think of this? Like, you know when you've been drinking for ages, and then you just, like, snog someone, and it's like...
Oh, come on, Sean, you would not have stopped yourself from snogging Kris Kristofferson.
Yeah, but I would have offered him a glass of water or something to start off with.
Sausage pizza for breakfast?
No, it's pepperoni. You got the biscuits ready?
I never made biscuits in my life. I was just doing a number on
them. I know, that's why I brought the pizza. Got anything to drink? Anything to drink in here?
You mean like orange juice?
Trying to improve my character?
You could use it.
We haven't described Chris's physique, his wardrobe, like, go on.
Chris is very, very, very sexy.
In what way,
Sean? Well, because he's lean. I love them lean. And he's not, he has nice, lean, sinewy arms, but he's not, like, muscular or too skinny or anything.
He has salt and pepper beard.
Yeah.
Kind of Jesus-style hair.
Lovely blue eyes.
And he wears these, a lot of these kind of, like, deep-cut, cleavage-revealing tops that kind of show off his chest. His bronzed California tan is constantly on display through this movie.
Oh, I love a California tan.
I think you would have fallen for Charles Manson the way you're
describing
this.
Well, I do have a habit of falling into cults. But that's not for here. Okay?
So basically, Barbara is an innocent girl. You know, she's just living her life. I mean, you can trace Esther's progression through the movie by the outfits that she wears.
Yeah, so, like, more and more. They go from embarrassing to ludicrous.
So, in the first musical number with the crazy hair being backlit in a red halo. She's wearing this, like, ridiculous, tacky, quite old-fashioned sort of stripy button-down shirt and these sparkling suspenders, which you would call braces, but I would call suspenders.
But this is where I just find her whole look to be mortifying, okay? Because to either side of her, the Oreos are just like, they feel to me so 70s, you know what I mean? Their hair is, you know, straightened, they're in their little outfits, they've got red lipstick on, they're just kind of boogieing to the music. And Barbara is there looking like a lesbian substitute teacher.
From a children's television
show.
She's like, honestly, remember we mentioned that Emma Thompson plays Nanny G on Cheers? Like, that is what she looks like. It's like day glow pastel colors. Okay, and then were you shocked or horrified when we watched the final credits where there's a costume designer listed and then it says, Miss Streisand's costumes, ...
From her own closet.
That's literally what it says in the credits. So basically, Barbara, all the outfits in A Star Is Born, Barbara has worn in real life at some point.
Once.
Can we just run through some of the most memorable looks? I mean, once she and Kris Kristofferson get together, obviously the looks increase in their kind of quote-unquote glamour.
Okay, so the one she wears to the first concert she attends with him, she wears a white tea cozy on her head, okay? And she wears a cardigan dress made of the same white knitted...
It's like a knitted sweater.
Yeah, with no bra underneath.
John Peters would have loved that.
This is California, okay? It just looked, oh God, it looked uncomfortable and embarrassing.
She has a white bell-bottom number at one point where they roll around in the mud and it's clearly like bright white so that she can get kind of mud all over her ass. And John Peters probably art-directed that as well.
There's her building outfits. I'm pretty sure this is an album cover as well. She's wearing a Superman t-shirt and these white shorts and like tube socks up to her knees and like Converse or something.
That was kind of a cute look. That was the sort of thing that, like, if you saw some hipster girl in East London wearing it, you'd be like, that's very on trend.
Well, if I saw a hipster girl wearing that, I'd be like, she's seen the 1976 Star Is Born, so she can't be all bad.
Yeah, no, totally. There were a couple looks that worked, but then she'll follow those up with, like, an insane poncho and a purple turban while riding a horse.
Yeah.
She goes, I mean, later, we're jumping ahead, but she goes to the Grammy Awards, and she's wearing this thing that's like Cruella de Vil meets, you know, Norma Desmond by way of, like, Fritz Lang's Metropolis. It's this, like, silver lame, you know, drapery thing. And you're just like, who in 1976 would wear this to the Grammys?
Well, what about your first ever musical performance where you wear a business executive suit, which I'm sure my mother wore to her. I think my mother wore that exact suit in about 1987. And I'm saying it looks wonderful if you work in the civil service in Athlone, but I don't think it looks great on stage if you're Barbara Streisand.
Did your mother have that voice, though, Sean?
No, but actually she did have curly hair at one point.
Mm. Yeah. So that has been our cavalcade through Barbara's looks. I hope that that description alone has made some people immediately download this film. Can we just run through some of the other absurdities of the plot points in the scene? So Kris Kristofferson lives in this rambling house that seems like it's straight out of Citizen Kane, and he kind of takes Barbara there, and of course she's still in her innocent girl phase, so she's walking around saying things like, this would be a perfect house for two people who never want to see each other. You know, like, she's never felt to me more borscht belt than she is in this movie. Like, it's like, Fanny Bryce, funny girl, I'm just delivering these lines and a little zingers from here and there, you know?
I still, waters run deep.
Speaking of waters, what kind of bed does Kris Kristofferson have?
A water bed. Barbara is commenting on, you know, who cleans this place up because there's old pizza boxes everywhere, there's beer cans, whatever. He has no idea, it just seems to get cleaned up. And when we see the bed, all I could think of was, who changes those sheets and how often?
Yeah. Ugh. What do they find in there? Then he spray paints her name, Esther, on one of the walls, and this is a grand gesture of love. Then there's, like, ridiculous scenes early on where they compose music together. Now, we haven't talked much about the quality of the music in A Star Is Born. Barbara co-wrote a couple of the songs, including the one genuine hit that came out of the film, which is Evergreen.
True.
But the first one that they composed together, Barbara's, like, at the piano, like, tinkling away, and Kris Kristofferson is like, I'll play some more of those, what do you call them, arpeggios. You know, and he's like, sounds really great, yeah, really, really interesting. Then they start, like, improvising together. I think this was the part that just was, like, nails on a chalkboard to you.
Oh, that was so good! I just got don't so quit. Lost in what you were doing, I forgot my own song. Can we continue?
Yeah.
Okay.
Pick it up.
Right, where I was going, ready. Okay, ready?
Then you came.
No. I'm sorry.
You gotta get past that word or you'll never forgive me, man. Come on, it gets prettier.
Okay.
It makes me realize that the words are meaningless to people. Songwriters and lyricists, the words they come up with, they mean absolutely nothing. But I have an issue with songs that are inevitably about love, that are ultimately about nothing.
Well, I have to say, like, these words were, like, particularly laughable. The significant lyric in that song is, you came inside me, and now I'm lost inside your mind.
Yeah.
I mean, Alan and Marilyn Bergman, you know,
they were out having a cigarette.
They needed to be brought in to you know, do a punch-up job on those lyrics. Evergreen, I have to say, it's always been, I think, an underappreciated Barbara song. I know it's not always been your favorite, even in your deep dive to Barbara over the holiday season, but it does really work in this movie.
Do you know what, though? Whenever I plan to sing Evergreen, I always end up singing The Wind Beneath My Wings.
Wait, what do you mean by plan to sing it? Like, no, it's you like, write it into your agenda?
It's like, I can feel it swelling up inside, and then I'll be like, did you ever know that you're my hero? And I'll be like, fuck, wrong movie.
Evergreen has such wonderful poetic imagery, you know, like a rose under the April snow. I was always certain love would grow. I mean, that's a beautiful image, you know? Love soft is an easy chair.
Yeah, at least they're images, Brian.
There's an earlier lyric where she's singing with the Oreos and she says something like, I want everything. I want to play the cello. I want to play Othello. And
I want to eat some jello, but only if it's blue.
I'd like to build a city and play the cello, play at Monte Carlo and play Othello, move into the White House, paint it yellow, sweet Portuguese and Dutch.
Great songs, these are not. So,
nope.
Following the Star is Born trajectory, he's meant to perform at a big benefit. In this version, it's for the American Indian Relief Fund.
Which I'm keen on.
What? Relief of American Indians?
Not only that, but the fact that that was the centerpiece of the film.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of appropriation of images of the frontier, which we can get to. But the fact that it's at this particular benefit means that when Barbara is finally dragged out on stage, Kris Kristofferson has kind of orchestrated this so that he won't finish his song and everybody's upset, and then he brings out Esther and she knocks him dead with her voice. But while Barbara is doing all these vocal pyrotechnics, there's a giant picture of, like, Sitting Bull floating in the background behind her.
The friend who we saw it with, she was like, and what was with all the Native American stuff when she was doing it? And we were like, it was for a charity concert. Like, I think I would have enjoyed A Star Is Born a bit more if I saw most of it out of context.
You mean, like, on the background at, like, a trippy sex party or something like
no,
that?
No, literally, what I'm meaning is, like, if just a few scenes, like, mini scenes were cut out of it, so I'm kind of confused all the time.
There was absolutely no narrative coherence.
Yeah, it's like, okay, so now there's an Indian chief.
There was an Indian chief, and he said... Okay, so speaking of Indians, there's a whole sequence where they go off and, you know, they're married now, they're in love, she's becoming a big star, she's cutting her own records. What do you do, Sean, when you really want to get away from it all? Where do you go? of course, you go to Arizona and you build yourself a ranch house. How did you feel about that?
At this point, it seemed like a natural thing to do, didn't it?
But literally, it seems like they build it. So he takes her out to, like, Arizona, where he has this massive plot of land, this gorgeous vista of, like, the Sierra Nevada or something or other. And they're, like, riding horses. And she's wearing this very Yentl-esque kind of peasant outfit with these, like, gypsy print skirts and crazy hat. And there's no house there, yeah?
No.
And then there's scenes of them, like, riding a tractor and everything in this montage, and then suddenly there's a house, and you're like, did they not call a contractor? Did Barbara and Chris literally build this?
They built it out of unleavened bread.
Loft, yeah, with their bare hands, you know. And then we get a bit of like insight into Barbara's love life. Like, presumably all of this was based on things she really did with her and John Peters, and they're like lounging around in the stucco ranch house and saying things like, let's have a breakfast in bed. I'll get some oysters and Greek olives, some peanut butter and jelly and unfiltered honey. And like, to me, I literally, like, my jaw dropped when I heard the phrase unfiltered honey, because I was just like, that is like an example of, that is probably just what Barbara Streisand likes. She just likes unfiltered honey. Mm-hmm. But it's like, why do we need to drop in the fact that it's unfiltered? Like, that is just going to bring us out of the movie.
Well, that's a Streisand moment, isn't it?
It's just like the most random detail. While all this is going on, Esther is becoming a big star. Obviously, Kris Kristofferson is dropping down further into his descent into drugs and depression and all of that. There's a memorable scene where they're sort of upset with each other and yelling at each other while a photo shoot is going on at the ranch house. And
Great scene.
Yeah, and we were pleasantly surprised to discover someone else appearing in this movie.
Yes, there's a very energetic photographer who's saying things like, Esther, if you could only just relax your face, you're giving me everything. It's so wonderful, Esther, my God.
Well, the light is fantastic.
And who is it? Only a young Sally Kirkland.
She was just following Barbara around everywhere in these days.
So in the first episode, I think we talked about, like, do Barbara and Sally still keep in touch? Well, maybe they do, you know? I'm beginning to think they might.
So, like, can we just whiz through any other wonderful moments? Like, basically, I don't know if we've said this yet, but I think we both agree that in the last movement of the film, once Esther has become a big star,
yeah,
we basically get what I think is probably the most accurate portrait that has ever been committed to film of what working with or for Barbara Streisand is like.
Yeah, so Esther has become so famous that she's getting her own TV special, as is the way. There's a big three-dimensional neon sign that genuinely looks gorgeous that says Esther. And she is there up on stage performing, and, you know, she's worried about John, and she's a bit kind of frazzled by the whole thing. And then, you know, she stops the playback, and she talks to the director of the show, and she's like, you know, I can't really walk down these stairs. This is a pivotal moment of the song. I need all my concentration, and I can't sing when I'm walking. I mean, walk when I'm singing. And, you know, earlier there were little pieces of white tape on these steps, and now they're gone. And could someone get them back? It's like, it's just Barbara.
And it's just like,
she's here.
It feels so accurate, and like, it, to be honest, this is like the fascinating quality of the film is like that seed of her perfectionism, her insistent control over everything. It does grow throughout the movie. So when they're recording the Evergreen track, you know, at first the musicians are playing and she's saying to Kristofferson, she's like, I don't want to be demanding, but I'm a perfectionist, and it's just like, to me, when I hear it in my head, it's not this wah wah wah. It's lighter and there's more strings, and you just know that that's how Barbara talks to all her collaborators. She's like, this has to match my vision, and as we know, Sean, a vision's just a vision if it's only in your head. If no one gets to see it, it's as good as dead. It has to come to light.
Brian, we're gonna have to start paying royalties if we keep at this.
Okay, so Kris Kristofferson, he is proud of Esther, but he's now not a star himself. He wants to branch out doing his own, like, acoustic music, which, you know, the record company is not interested. They don't want to sell. And then the movie kind of is trudging along towards its inevitable tragic climax. And here's where it does diverge a bit from the 54 version, right? We see them have a kind of meltdown at an award show. In this case, it's the Grammys, not the Oscars.
Yeah, and actually, in the 1954 version, again, the meltdown was kind of so easy to pinpoint because there's a part where James Mason shows up completely drunk to the Oscars just as Esther is accepting one, and he goes up on stage and mortifies her, and then as he's looking toward the crowd, he gestures and whacks her in the face. And
oh my god, it's one of the most painful things in any film ever.
And even if he didn't mean to do it, it's still completely painful and mortifying and embarrassing, and no one knows what to do, okay? And you're like, oh my god, their lives are crumbling. Whereas in this, you know,
He's already shown himself to be a complete drunken, drug-addled asshole for the whole movie. So his behavior at the Grammys is not appreciably worse than anything he's done before.
And there's a part of that in that scene where he knocks her over onto the escalator, but he falls too, and it just doesn't have any of the same effect.
No. And how did you feel there's then a bit where he goes back to their rambling Citizen Kane mansion and he finds this sort of naked journalist groupie swimming in the pool and he ends up bedding her and she comes in and finds the two of them in bed together and they have this kind of fight where she's saying, I hate you and you can trash your life but you're not going to trash mine.
Yeah. If I can just jump in here for 1 second. That girl who he meets in the swimming pool really makes you remember how weird Barbara is in this whole film.
In what way?
Because that girl, to me, that kind of dope-tempered, like, surfboard-shaped girl, is so 70s to me. She has the demeanor...
I thought it was Shelley Duvall for a minute.
So did I. I'm not gonna... dare I say it, a prettier Shelley Duvall. I also thought it was Shelley Duvall. She has this quality to her, this like spaced out, far out, yeah, kind of thing that just feels so of the decade. And when Barbara and her are in the same room, it's like, I totally understand what John Peters meant. Barbara is never contemporary.
I see what you mean. It's like Barbara's in 70s drag, but she's not 70s.
No.
Which is weird because she was a huge recording artist of the time. Her movies were successful. This movie was successful. So there was clearly like an audience in the 70s that responded to Barbara, but somehow it just didn't feel very up to the minute or cutting edge.
True.
And let's be honest, the music that she sings as Esther in this movie is not cutting edge rock and roll either.
No, but it doesn't suit her either. Do you not think so?
No, I mean, it allows her all these vocal pyrotechnics, but it, like, when she does her musical performances in this movie, she's like shaking her ass and shimmying, but she has this like stiff, bug-eyed expression half the time that just like is like someone's told Barbara to like perform in this way, and you're just like, can't you just sit on a stool and flip your hair back and like
and just sing, I finally found someone.
Yeah, or in this case, you know, on a clear day, like something. Just be a cabaret performer. That's what you are.
But this is exactly it. It all comes down to authenticity, and you know, Barbara is a huge star, but she's not this kind of star.
What I think she and John Peters mistook for authenticity is literally having all the clothes be Barbara's own clothes.
Yeah.
Having Kris Kristofferson's red Ferrari actually be the red Ferrari that John Peters himself drove. So it's like...
It's very clinical authenticity, isn't it?
Yeah, it's almost like that Gus Van Sant, like, shot-for-shot psycho. It's like, let's put in as much of our own stuff here, our own psychological baggage, our own clothes, our own belongings, and somehow people will think they're getting an insight into our lives. And that does make it, like, weirdly fascinating.
Yeah.
Also, apparently, they had issues with the man character committing suicide, as he does in all the other versions of A Star Is Born. In this, they sort of reconcile after he cheats on her. They, you know, go back to the ranch house. They have a few afternoons of romance. And then he, like, gets in a car to go drive to pick somebody up. And he's, like, drinking a can of Schlitz beer.
Oh,
and
do you know that?
Yeah, it's famous. And then he's, like, driving recklessly. And you're like, okay, so he's going to crash the car. We don't see him actually crash the car.
Which I actually kind of liked.
Well, do you know why?
Because it's John Peters' car.
Yeah, they didn't want to crash John Peters' real car.
The scene is quite extended as
Barbara's worst acting in this movie, and probably ever, is her discovery of his dead body. What did you feel about that?
Yeah, I wasn't buying it.
Gotta move, miss.
Huh?
Gotta move, Mary. Come on.
No.
Yes, we gotta move.
No.
Come on.
No. No.
I mean, it's just so, it lacks emotion so completely. And when you think about how much we praised her in The Way We Were for that phone scene where she's legitimately vulnerable, it's like she's looking at his dead body and she just is like, I mean, maybe she's trying to play that thing of like numbness, but it just, it doesn't read at all. There's an extended sequence where she's wandering around the mansion looking at all the belongings and the empty rooms, and she's listening to like the tape recordings that he left, and she's like yelling at, you know, the recording, saying things like, I don't know what to do, I'm lost without you. But then the real emotional climax of the film is this long final musical performance,
which in the 1954 version is Judy coming out at the Oscars and saying, I'm Mrs. Norman Maine. And that is all we need for that powerful intensity. In this, which does its best to pay homage to that scene, we hear an announcer saying, Esther Hoffman Howard. And she comes out. I mean, Esther Hoffman Howard sounds like she should be doing a cake sale.
Or like an ad for like, you know, indigestion pills.
Yeah.
So
no offense, Esther. So she comes out and in a quite a touching, if not also hard-to-believe moment, everyone in the audience just takes their lighters out and matches and puts the flames up, you know?
Well, they know that she's suffered a loss, but then we get tight close-up of Barbara's face, yet again the backlit red halo on the fro, and she sings basically two songs strung together in this one continuous shot,
yeah,
where you're just like, she's giving it 10,000% of Barbara, like the full-on voice. It is amazing, but like utterly and completely soulless, yeah. I would say.
At this point, I was really hungry. I just wanted the film to end.
It's almost as if they're just like, look at our star. Here she is singing. Here she is giving it full-throated emotion. Yeah. It sort of blends into the song that Kris Kristofferson sang earlier in the film. And it ends on a red freeze frame of Barbara's face as the credits roll by. And then we get Evergreen again. I hope that we have interested some people in watching A Star Is Born, because I was probably a bit more keen on it than you were, Sean. But, like, would you say that it is, in some ways, and a kind of amazing oddity to see?
Oh, absolutely. And those concert scenes were incredible. You know, just, it's a time capsule. It is an insight into Hollywood and a star and the zeitgeist in a really haphazard way. And that's probably a recommendation.
How would you feel if you had won an Oscar for the screenplay of Dog Day Afternoon, one of the greatest movies of the 70s, and while you went to accept that Oscar, you knew that, you know, the next day you had to be bossed around by Barbara Streisand and her hairdresser boyfriend, because that's who directed this movie, Frank Pearson.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. I would have been much more interested in it as the director if I knew that John Peters wasn't putting his fingers all over it. Do you know what I mean? The idea of doing a Barbra Streisand A Star Is Born is interesting, but not when it's a vanity piece between her and her boyfriend.
Yeah. Okay, so we've gone through the full Barbra canon. You've listened to every single B-side and deep cut of Barbra.
Oh, yes, of course.
Has it been worth it, Sean?
It's been good, but I want to get out of it. I want to leave. I don't want any more of this. I've proved to all of you that I'm in fact nuts.
She's driven you completely nuts. You won't let her rain on your parade. But now you need some other people. You're just someone who needs people.
I'm someone who needs people.
Yeah.
I'm the luckiest person
in the world. Can I just say one thing about that lyric? Like, people who need people are not the luckiest people in the world.
Explains to me.
Well, okay, if you need people, why are you lucky? If you have people in your life, you're lucky. But if you just need them and you're on a desert island, you're not lucky.
No, you're being pedantic now.
No. If Bob Merrill was still around, I would write him a letter about this.
No, people who need people, as in, like, you will constantly have people in your life. That's what it's saying to me.
You might not have them. Maybe you're standoffish and off-putting.
No, if you need people, you'll get them.
Okay, maybe you're just more optimistic than I am.
There's a reason why that song is famous, bro.
What's that?
It's good. It's really good.
Well, so speaking of people, we've got a whole big group of people, female category, that we will be covering in the remainder of our Good, Bad, Crazy series.
Oh my god, we got 5 more of these to do. Then do you remember when we used to just watch one movie?
Oh my god. God, those were the days.
Yeah.
Luckily, the next woman that we will be talking about is absolutely fierce and incredible. We have covered her once before, but Angela Bassett is an actress of kind of extraordinary force and power. And in terms of someone who's had good, profitable movies, some really stinkers, let's say, in which she's been totally lost, and some crazy ones that we forgot about, I think it's going to be a fascinating look at a very different career.
Yes.
So, join us, won't you, in 2 weeks' time for the good, the bad, and the crazy of Angela Bassett. Please leave us a rating or a review if you like Broad Appeal on Apple Podcasts. And how can people follow us on Twitter, Sean?
Well, you can follow us at Broad Appeal Pod. We also have our own individual Twitter handles. I'm at Sean McGovern X, and he's at B.A. Mullen Speaks.
But please, don't tag Barbara Streisand into any of your tweets and retweets, because I don't know if I can deal with the vengeance that she'll wreak upon us.
And her fans.
She'll send, you know, Alan and Marilyn Bergman down to our house with a subpoena.
Yeah.
All right. Sean, love is soft as an easy chair.
Time to get into comfy bed.
Bye-bye, everyone. Bye.